Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The incredible story of a 1958 murder that ended with the last woman to ever be executed in California. A murder so twisted it seems ripped from a Greek tragedy. Deborah Larkin was only 10 years old when the quiet calm of her California suburb was shattered. 30 miles north, on a quiet November night in Santa Barbara, a pregnant nurse named Olga Duncan disappeared from her apartment. The mystery deepens when it is discovered that Olga's mother-in-law, a deeply manipulative and deceptive woman, had been doing everything in her power to separate Olga and her son Frank prior to Olga's disappearance. From a forged annulment to multiple attempts to hire people to get rid of Olga to a faked extortion case, Elizabeth seemed psychopathically attached to her son. Yet she denied having anything to do with Olga's disappearance with a smile. But when Olga's brutally beaten body is found in a shallow grave, apparently buried alive, a young DA makes it his mission to see that Elizabeth Duncan is brought to justice. Adding a wrinkle to his efforts is the fact that Frank, himself a defense attorney, maintained his mother's innocence to the end. How does a young girl process such a crime along with the fear and disbelief that rocked an entire community? Decades later, Larkin is determined to revisit the case and bring the story of Olga herself to light. Long overshadowed by the sensationalism and scandal of Elizabeth and Frank, a lovely girl seems to reveal Olga as a woman in full, someone who was more than the twisted family that would ultimately ensnare her. As we follow the heart-pounding drama of the case through Larkin's young eyes, her father was the court reporter. A lovely girl is page-turning yet poignant and makes the reader re-examine how we handle fear, how we regard mental illness, and how we understand family as we carve our own path in a dangerous world. The book that we're featuring this evening is A Lovely Girl, The Tragedy of Olga Duncan and the Trial of One of California's Most Notorious Killers, with my special guest, author Deborah Larkin. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Deborah Larkin.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on this extraordinary book.
Thank you.
Let's start off right away with Ventura, California, 1958. And tell us about your family. I said in the introduction that you were 10 years old at that time in 1958. Tell us about your family and how you came to be the author of this book.
My family lived in a small subdivision. It was built in a walnut orchard. My father was a newspaper reporter and very much a character and well-known in the community. My mother was a psychiatric social worker at Camarillo State Hospital, which was a California state mental hospital. And I, at 10 years old, was in some ways precocious. I read everything in the newspaper, and most of all, I was a big worrier. And so when Olga disappeared and then her body was discovered, I became obsessed with this crime and wondering how this could possibly happen. That was sort of my worst nightmare, for someone to disappear into the middle of the night and then the body found in a shallow grave near my home.
Tell us about your dad's career and the relationship you forge, especially over this case.
Well, I always was a daddy's girl. I was interested in everything he did. And he was, like I said, he was a newspaper reporter for the local paper. And he was assigned to cover this tragedy from the time Olga disappeared through the investigation, through the trial of her killers. And so I felt that I could get inside information for him and from him. And so besides reading all of his columns, I asked a lot of questions. And also I would describe my father as having no filter. So nothing was really out of bounds for him as far as discussions at home. And he used to talk about Olga Duncan's disappearance and all the things that happened afterwards right around the dinner table.
Let's get to November 17th, 1958 in Santa Barbara. Olga Duncan is pregnant, and she has a party with two of her work friends from the hospital. Tell us who Olga Duncan is, where she works, and about this night in particular, November 17th, 1958.
Olga, at that time, was a surgical nurse at Cottage Hospital in Santa Barbara. I got the title of the book, A Lovely Girl, because that's how she was described, especially her landlady first brought it up. But everybody had nothing but wonderful things to say about Olga, that she was just a lovely girl. And at the time she disappeared, she was separated from her husband, Frank Duncan, who was a criminal defense attorney in Santa Barbara. Frank had moved home to live with his mother because his mother was really just obsessed with her son. She was also insisted that she could never live alone. And she just harassed Frank until he finally left his wife and moved home to live with her. And that was only like a few weeks after the wedding. He didn't live a full time with Olga for any time at all. And he also, I think he said that he thought that if he could wait till the baby was born, that maybe everything would be fine, that his mother would be reconciled with the situation. But at the time, she harassed Olga. She said terrible things to people about Olga. She tried to get the stores in Santa Barbara to cut off any credit for Olga. She showed up at the apartment where Olga lived and got the landlady to let her in to go inside the apartment. And she tried to tell the landlady that they weren't really married, that Olga was a terrible person and that they abandoned children in Canada. And that's another thing. Olga had moved to Santa Barbara from Canada the year before because there was a nurse shortage in California. And she thought that that would be someplace that she would enjoy living. And so she got the job in Santa Barbara.
Now, what happens with that evening? She was talking to her friends, and you talked about that these apartments, there was a Mrs. Barnett that was the landlady, and she had experienced those things with Olga's mother-in-law. But that night, she met with some friends, and then they left. The landlady thought that something else had happened a little bit later in the evening. Tell us about what the landlady heard a little bit after those friends had left.
Well, she heard footsteps on the stairs, but she thought that it was Frank leaving. She wasn't at that time really, didn't really realize that Frank had pretty much moved out of there because he did come sometimes to visit Olga. So when she heard the footsteps on the stairs, she just thought it was Frank going out for cigarettes, she said. And she actually mentioned this to another tenant. She also said that she thought maybe it was another tenant, a young couple that sometimes went to the movies. She thought it might have been them also. But when she talked to the tenant, they hadn't gone out at all. And so that concerned her.
These nurses that worked with her were concerned. And so then there was a missing persons report. And then you introduce a couple characters, Detective Jim Hansen and somebody that's even more important character in this story, Detective Charlie Thompson. What happens? What do they hear immediately about particulars of this case? And they speak to Frank Duncan.
Yes, the first day, they were still thinking, well, maybe she just took off. Frank said that she might have done this to get back at him for not living at the house. But they also heard from the landlady that day that the Mrs. Duncan, the mother, Elizabeth Duncan, was harassing Olga and hated her daughter-in-law and had threatened that she would kill her daughter-in-law. So Frank, when they interviewed him, Frank was actually there when Olga was reported missing. She was over at the apartment and talked to the detectives and told them that he thought she just, disappeared on her own and that she'd be back. But he also said that his mother never did say any of these things. So Frank was very much trying to downplay everything when Olga disappeared. He didn't feel that it was that anything had happened to her and denied that his mother had made threats.
The police found that her purse was still in the apartment. What else led them to believe that maybe she hadn't run off?
Well, the apartment was left. The lights were on. The dishes from the refreshments that she'd served to her two nurse friends that night were still just sitting there on the counter. And also the bed was turned down, but it had not been slept in. So that made them think that possibly she had left in the middle of the night. She had two cases of luggage that Frank insisted were gone, but that was sort of contradictory to the purse still being there. And that was one of the things that Detective Hansen thought right from the beginning, was that he doesn't know any women that would go off and leave their purse behind. So that made him wonder. And then when they started interviewing Olga's friends, the nurses at the hospital, and called her family in Canada, they learned that Olga had been fearful of her mother-in-law and that Mrs. Elizabeth Duncan had been harassing her, wanting her to leave her son alone.
And meanwhile, as you say, Frank seems to have denied anything like that, that his mother would have been capable of anything like that. And that's what they have to deal with moving forward.
Right.
Meanwhile, you write that November 21st in Santa Barbara, California, Gus Baldonado and his buddy Luis Moya is with Esperanza Esquivel, owner of the Tropical Cafe and Bar. What's happening that day? And what are they discussing?
Well, in that chapter, they are meeting up. They drive Mrs. Esquivel to a drive-in restaurant in Santa Barbara, and she is there to collect money, we discover. Now, during that scene, we don't know exactly what she's collecting the money for, but she meets with Mrs. Duncan at the restaurant, and Mrs. Duncan tries to give her a $200 check, which Mrs. Esquivel says, no, no. Luis Moya, she's there representing them, says, no, no checks. It's got to be cash. So that leads to sort of a wander down State Street in Santa Barbara, first meeting with Luis Moya and Gus Baldonado at the Woolworths. And she tries to get them to take the check. And finally, Luis Moya does agree. He's, you know, not happy about it, but he wants to go on a vacation. His parole officer has told him he can leave town. So she goes over and cashes the check at a bank. And then that was Luis's idea. And then they meet again at another store in Santa Barbara. And that's where she turns over part of the money. But Mrs. Duncan did not want to give the whole $200. So she keeps 50 for herself and gives the rest to Luis.
But there is a much bigger financial deal that is supposed to culminate the next week. Tell us about what
right.
she tells them.
Right. Luis says they apparently have asked for a lot more money than $200. And Mrs. Duncan says that she is going, she calls it Frisco, in the next week and selling some of her stock certificates. And these men are not well, not very sophisticated about those kinds of things. So she just kind of says what she wants about how she will be getting that money. And because she is going to give them the full $6,000, she says, they have agreed that they will take this partial payment.
Now, meanwhile, you have Detective Hansen is interviewing Frank Duncan. And I think he understood that Frank's mother was supposed to accompany Frank to this police station interview. And so he asked Frank, where is your mother? Tell us about this interaction between them.
Well, the reason why Frank is going to bring his mother to the police station is because when Mrs. Duncan got home that day after, you know, giving money to Lewis and Gus, he wants to know where that check is because it was supposed to go to pay for a typewriter that he had bought.
Mm-hmm.
And she can't come up with a receipt or the check or anything. So she decides to say, she tells him that she has been blackmailed and that she had to give the $200 to these two men that work at the Esperanza Esquivel's cafe because Frank had actually represented Mr. Esquivel in a criminal case and Mrs. Esquivel was not satisfied with the outcome. Her husband had to go to jail. And so that's what Mrs. Duncan tells her son, that she's being blackmailed by these people because Mr. Escobar went to jail. So that's when Frank then says, well, first he wants to go over to the Tropical Cafe and take care of this himself. He thinks it's ridiculous and he's furious. And she begs him not to, that they'll kill him, that they threaten to kill the both of them if they don't get money back. And so Frank insists that they go to the police department and he takes his mother there. But at first, when Frank goes in to sit down with Detective Hansen, his mother isn't with him. She's sitting in the car because she doesn't want to go in. She doesn't like police and she doesn't want to go into the police station with her son. She wants him to just tell them about it.
Well, that won't work with police. So they have her come in. They suggest that if she has seen these people that have threatened her, well, then she'll be able to identify them. What about that idea that she will be able to identify them in a lineup and to look at some photos? Is she warm to that idea at all?
No. She claims that she was so afraid when she was approached. She just happened to be walking by the cafe and they grabbed her and pulled her in, that she was so afraid that she really can't remember what they looked like. And she's insisting that she wouldn't be able to identify them.
They suggest that they will put a listening device on her phone. So she, again, is kind of hesitant to help out police, but Frank is seriously considering putting the tap on the phone. He's in agreement, isn't he?
Correct. Yes. He really prods his mother that we have to do this. We're not going to pay blackmailers. And so, yes, he tells the police that they will have it on their phone.
So what happens as moving forward with this investigation?
Well, Mrs. Duncan doesn't seem to be able to record it. She claims that the listening device won't work, but that the callers did call in, or Gus and Moya called another time, and she did pay them a little bit more money. But Frank is very, very annoyed with his mother because it's a very simple procedure to do, but
right,
she claims, nope, it just won't work.
So what about this lineup, and what about her reluctance to think that she can confidently identify these people? Well, what's Frank's reaction?
Well, Frank, they're in that room looking through the other side of the two-way mirror to see the people in the lineup. And she claims at first, no, that she doesn't see anybody. She doesn't recognize anybody. And Frank just gets in her face and said, come on, mother. Oh, because she has already, she eventually did pick mugshot out. Frank kept prodding her and prodding her. She picked a mugshot out. They brought the guy in. And when she sees him in the lineup, she says, no, his hair's not right. That's not the guy. And Frank is really angry and gets in his mother's face and says, you know, you recognize him, mother. You see him. He was the one in the mugshot. And at that point, the detective kind of intervenes and says, no, please, Mr. Duncan, you've got to leave her alone. She needs to make this investigation or this identification. But she's still hemming and hawing, and Frank goes at him again. And this time, the detective just is quiet because he's thinking that this extortion case is not going to go anywhere. And by that time, they've already started to suspect that it is somehow linked to Olga's disappearance. So he decides to just let Frank, you know, say whatever he wants to his mother. And so after that, she's sticking with it. She doesn't recognize anybody. And so when they leave that room and they go to a different part of the police station, Frank suggests that they should bring the number, I forget, it was number 4, whoever it was that he thinks it is, in the room for Mrs. Duncan to meet to see if she can identify him. And the two detectives talk, and this is highly irregular, but they think, well, we'll just take it and see where it goes. They've sort of given up on the extortion case. And so they bring Louis Moya in, and he tries to shake hands with both of them, and Frank won't shake his hand. And again, she says, no, this is not the guy. And when they take Louis Moya away, Frank just goes ballistic. And he's saying, you know, that's the man that you saw in those mugshots. And this point, she finally says, well, he just looks like such an innocent little lamb. I just don't like. Prison's a terrible thing, and I wouldn't want anybody to have to be there. And so at that point, Frank says, I'm leaving tonight, mother. I'm gonna go and live. I'm leaving you in the apartment if you can't identify this man. And again, the detectives know, well, this isn't gonna stick for the extortion case, but they just let it go. Let's see what happens. And she finally says, okay, yeah, that's the guy, but I'm not going to testify against him. And if I do, the other man is still at large, or, you know, he's still, and he will kill us. And we should be afraid that he will kill us. So then the detectives say, okay, well, we're done investigating the extortion case. But they're, of course, realize that this is possibly linked. Those two men could possibly be linked to the disappearance because they have come to believe that Mrs. Duncan is involved in her daughter-in-law's disappearance, but they have no evidence. And so they decide to just keep moving with it in that direction.
There was a woman, a very important character that is introduced, you introduced. It's an older woman. She's 83 or 84 years old, and her name is Emma Short. And she is with Betty Duncan, Elizabeth Duncan. And so the police think, well, maybe we should interview this woman. And of course, not to arouse suspicion, but when they say, we'd like to speak to your friend, of course, Mrs. Duncan says, you don't need to talk to her. She doesn't know anything. You don't need to talk to her. So they go talk to her. What does Emma Short have to say?
Well, yes, they live in the same apartment building. Emma lives downstairs. Mrs. Duncan lives in the upstairs apartment just above her. So she kind of keeps an eye on Emma. And so they decide to both go to the apartment building. A Detective Hansen goes upstairs to talk to Mrs. Duncan and try to work out things with that listening device that she's having trouble with. That's just to keep her busy. And Detective Thompson goes to see Emma. And at first, she just doesn't want to say anything. She's very afraid. But she is, like I would call, a sidekick. She goes everywhere with Mrs. Duncan. So she's been a witness to all that has been going on. And so finally, Detective Thompson convinces her that she needs to tell them what happened. And Emma says she's afraid that Mrs. Duncan does things to people who cross her. But Thompson convinces her that they will protect her. So they leave to go to the Santa Barbara police station to have a real interview with Mrs. Short. And little at a time when they're there, she tells them about the extortion case, that she made that up because she had to tell him something about the checks. She lets them know that there was a phony annulment that Mrs. Duncan impersonated her daughter-in-law and got another guy to play Frank, that she went to get their marriage annulled. And then when that didn't work, she started looking, shopping around, as they've said, for someone to get rid of Olga.
Now, how did they get back to Esperanza Esquivel and the names Luis Moya and Gus Baldonado come to police's attention?
Well, it actually at first is not through Mrs. Esquivel. I mean, she doesn't tell them the names right away. But when they see they know that Luis Moya, who was finally identified in one of the mugshots and was in the lineup, they know that he hangs out at the Tropical Cafe. And so they decide that they're going to talk to Mrs. Esquivel, who absolutely at first denies that she was upset with her husband's legal representation. There was no blackmailing, no anything. But once Mrs. Short starts to talk, she says that Luis Moya, and she can't really remember Gus's name. She calls him Gus Baldo. So then they go back and they talk to Mrs. Esquivel. They bring her into questioning after Mrs. Short has sort of spilled the beans. They bring Mrs. Esquivel in for questioning, and she tells how Mrs. Duncan came looking for somebody to help her get rid of her daughter-in-law, and that she introduced them to Luis Moya and Gus Baldonado.
Now, with this information, the police have to make a decision on how to conduct themselves most effectively. So many times, and in this particular case, they look for ways to arrest them without revealing what the actual charges are in this particular case, this conspiracy to murder. Tell us how they go about that with these two persons.
Well, Luis Moya was on probation. He had recently got out of state prison before he came to Santa Barbara. So he had broken some of the terms of his probation just by hanging out at the Tropical Cafe with Baldonado, because there were other ex-felons there. And actually driving a car while you were on probation was something that you weren't allowed to do. So they arrested Luis Moya on probation violations and put him in the Santa Barbara jail. And then Gus Baldonado, in their investigation of him, he had three children, two had just recently been born, and he'd never paid any child support. Well, in 1958, you could actually be jailed for failure to pay support. And they got his, it was an ex-wife at that point, even though he fathered those two new children, she did file the complaint. They pressured her to do that. So they picked up Gus Baldonado on failure to support charges, and he was put in the Ventura jail because that's where his ex-wife lived, was in Ventura County. And then they start to interview them.
Okay, so they get to the interviews. What do they realize, again, about weak link, how they're going to approach them, who to approach, who has decided that is the weak link and why, and then how do they approach him? How do they get confession from them?
Okay. Well, I think maybe I'd like to talk a little bit about that phony annulment, as Mrs. Duncan was arrested at the same time as all of this. Mm-hmm. So once they got the information from Mrs. Short about her getting this phony annulment for her son and Olga by impersonating Olga and getting somebody to impersonate Frank, they decided that they sent people down to Ventura, which is where she went. She went to Ventura County across the Santa Barbara line to get this phony annulment because she was too afraid that people in the courts would know Frank. And so once they got that information, they realized that they would need to talk to the Ventura County District Attorney, who was Gustafson, Roy Gustafson, and to get him to file a complaint for the arrest of Mrs. Duncan. So she was also in jail in Ventura and on the charges of forgery for forging things in that annulment. So they're all three in jail. And so now with the weak link, Thompson, Detective Thompson, is sent to the preliminary hearing of Mrs. Duncan on this forgery charge in case he needs to give testimony, because the DA in Santa Barbara does not want Mrs. Duncan let out on bail. He's afraid at this point she is going to run if she gets out on bail when she knows they've arrested Moya and Baldonado too.
Mm-hmm.
And so after the hearing, and Mrs. Duncan is held over on a very high amount of bail that she can't, you know, wouldn't be able to come up with the money to pay, Thompson goes up to Gustafson's office and they talk about who would be the weak link. And here's where Roy Gustafson comes in. This isn't really a crime that happened in his county. He is the Ventura DA, and it happened, a kidnapping at least, disappearance was in Santa Barbara. But Roy is a very ambitious guy. He's starting his third term as the DA of Ventura County, and he's only 42 years old. He first got elected in his early 30s. So, and he is a very much a hard-line guy as far as crime and punishment. So he would really like, he feels very strongly about these people having taken Olga and what has happened to her. So he really wants to help. And he decides that when there's discussion that Gus Baldonado would be the weak link. Gus is not the brightest guy in the world. Where Louis Moya is a very savvy guy. He started as a dishwasher at this restaurant in Santa Barbara, and within about 6 months worked his way up to night manager. He is very intelligent. He's been to prison before. No way is he going to talk. And Mrs. Duncan has Frank advising her to stay silent. So they feel that Gus is the only way that they're going to find out what really happened.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor. Do you ship product from your business? What if your business was treated like a Fortune 500 company with the discount power and customer service power usually reserved for the giants? What if you could pass on to your customers the money you save on shipping, or reinvest those precious dollars back into your company? Main Street Logistics offers their clients unbeatable shipping rates and unparalleled customer service. There's no more need to waste time comparing pricing with Main Street. You can rest assured that you are getting unparalleled discounts and a dedicated customer service team available to you 24/7, 365 days a year. There is never a need to get frustrated comparing rates or stuck talking to someone at the other end of a generic 1-800 number. Main Street Logistics provides you with headache-free shipping with the deepest possible discounts. Whether you're shipping within Canada, from Canada, or bringing goods into Canada, Main Street can help. Trust Main Street Logistics for all your shipping and courier needs. Domestic courier, international courier, LTL and FTL, ocean and cargo, warehousing and fulfillment. The Main Street Logistics team brings 25 years of experience to your shipping needs and will help your business punch above its weight. When you work with Main Street, you are treated like a Fortune 500 company, enjoying the discounts and service that a Fortune 500 receives. What I love most about Main Street Logistics is just how immediate, easy, and comfortable it is working with Tom and his partner, Marnie. They get the job done anywhere, anyhow, anytime. If you want to get in touch to see what they can do for you, visit www.mainstreetlogistics.ca. For a 10% discount, use promo code TRUEMURDER in the subject line of your email so that they know your friend Dan sent you. That's 10% off when you go to www.mainstreetlogistics.ca and use promo code TRUEMURDER in the subject line of your email. Main Street Logistics, front of the line, anywhere, anytime. Now, we talked about the weak link and all of the information that comes from Gus Baldonado, and you chronicle in your book the assistance of a reverend and a pastor and these people's contribution to extracting or soliciting these confessions from these two killers. First from Baldonado, and then reluctantly, and then finally from Luis Moya as well. Let's talk about the details that the police learned through that. And as a result, you already mentioned Roy Gustafson and his need and desire to prosecute these three killers to the utmost of the law. Tell us what he finds out as well, because he is part of this investigation. He wanted to be part of this investigation to help solve this case. What did they find out from these two killers?
Well, first of all, I think I'll mention that there was no Miranda warning in 1958.
Right.
So these men could not afford an attorney. And so none was appointed to them while they were being questioned. At that point, people got free attorneys, but it wasn't until they were actually charged in court for the crime.
Right.
So they had nobody giving them advice on what they should do. Moya was interrogated by two men. One was the investigator, Roy Gustafson's DA investigator, and another was by a deputy sheriff who, it turns out, had known Gus Baldonado when he was a boy in Camarillo. Gus had been in minor trouble his entire life, and he had a very dysfunctional home.
Right.
And so he tried to use that connection that he had in the investigation. And so eventually, it took a while, the deputy, Deputy Higgins, convinced Baldonado that he needed to talk now, because if he waited till Moya and Mrs. Duncan talked, then they would probably blame everything on him. So he did confess to what had happened, and he agreed that he would lead the detectives to where Olga's body was buried. And he told them that they did this because Mrs. Duncan paid them to do this. So then, once the body was discovered, you know, that was huge news in the community. And they went up to see Moya, who is still in jail on parole violation charges in Santa Barbara. And they went up to get him because they had arranged for the parole officer that was okay to hold him in Ventura as much as Santa Barbara. And when they were bringing him back, he'd said that he had tried to get his mother to get him an attorney, but she hadn't been able to get the money together to do that yet. But he wanted to speak to a reverend when he got to Ventura. This discussion was taking place on the drive down to Ventura. And so that's free, right? I could speak to a reverend, somebody who has a real church. And, you know, I think that the detective said, then you mean a priest? And he said, no, I want to speak to a reverend who has a church of his own. So when they got to Ventura, Reverend Gilbert, who is the reverend that used to come and help out with prisoners, help counsel prisoners at the jail. It was just before Christmas, and Olga's body was discovered on December 21st, and Roy Gustafson planned to have grand jury indict them, if possible, on December 26th. So Reverend Gilbert was just too busy with all of the things going on at church for Christmas time, and he said he couldn't come over until the night of Christmas, December 25th. And when he did come over, and I know this because Reverend Gilbert later testified at Moya's trial about what happened in that room, he told Moya wanted to save his soul. He really was worried that he was going to go to hell because he knew he had committed this terrible murder.
Right.
And he told the Reverend that he wanted him to pray with him and ask him if he could have a Bible. And Reverend Gilbert said, you know, as long as you're going to lie about this to men, your soul cannot be saved. And he said, unless you confess to men, it's not good enough just to confess to God that you have committed this crime. So Moya accepted that, and the Reverend left. And he told, I guess it was Roy Higgins on the way out, the deputy, Ray Higgins, that he thought he was ready to talk to you soon. And Ray just waited around the jail, and eventually somewhere around midnight, Moya said that he'd like to talk to Deputy Higgins. And that's when Moya confessed, and he pretty much told the same story as Gus Baldonado. So Roy Gustafson, the DA, Ventura DA, got word that night, and he started redoing his questions for the district attorney or for the grand jury. And the next morning is when they held the grand jury, and there was Moya testified, Baldonado testified, Mrs. Barnett, the landlady, all of these witnesses testified to what had happened in the grand jury indicted. Mrs. Duncan didn't testify, her. And Roy Gustafson decided not to worry about that, not to call her. And Frank Duncan even testified. And of course, trying to say his mother was innocent, but the grand jury indicted all three of the suspected killers for Olga's murder. Something interesting, I think, happened as a reader. You know, I'm a true crime. I'm interested in those kinds of things. And so I always read about current crimes in the newspapers. And I just don't think this ever happens. But what happened is the day after the grand jury, Roy Gustafson, it was his prerogative to do this, released all of the transcripts from the grand jury to the press.
Wow.
So as Ward Sullivan, Mrs. Duncan's attorney, said, you know, it was like all of the potential jurors in the county reading a serialized account of what went on in the grand jury. So people all over the county were reading what Moya had said and what Baldonado had said and what Mrs. Short had said. So, and that's why Ward Sullivan, the attorney for Mrs. Duncan, tried to get a change of venue for the trial, but the judge did not grant that.
We haven't mentioned that your father all along the way has been reporting on this, but also that he had some insider information within the police.
Correct.
Person by Charlie, the tech we already mentioned, Charlie Thompson.
Yes.
What are some of the kinds of things that your father was privy to and had information and which helped inform some of his articles as well?
Well, he did have, it was a much smaller towns and the police, and there wasn't quite the boundary that goes up, I think, today between the police investigation and newspaper reporters. So I can't tell you exactly everything that he knew, but he was talking to witnesses about Mrs. Duncan, about her history. He was talking to Charlie Thompson, and Charlie didn't, of course, release all of the details about his interview with Mrs. Short. And then some of the interviews, but he was giving him things that he thought was important to the investigation of the crime and how maybe the public would be able to, if they had seen something or heard something, that would be important. And then they would go to the police. So those were the kinds of things that Charlie released. And I don't believe that Roy Gustafson, although my dad felt like he was later years, almost a friend of Roy's. I mean, he was a very meticulous DA, and he wouldn't have done or said anything that he thought might have a negative effect on his ability to prosecute these killers.
Now, let's talk about this incredible trial, but also along the way, you have been following this case, reading what your father has written, seeing all of the reports. This has been covered by, as you say in the trial, 30 journalists. There's TV, radio, newswire services. There is a newspaper. So this is a big deal. And these are sensational headlines that accompany these stories. And Mrs. Duncan is a highly awaited person at this trial, isn't she? With her son, even though he's a witness, he is allowed to be at the trial through the entire duration, despite being a witness. And that would, again, is non-typical to be allowed.
He sits right behind the defense table. And what Sullivan has asked for him to be allowed in court, because he says that he's a vital piece of her defense. And so it's up to the DA whether he would allow that. And Roy Gustafson says, well, okay, if Frank's going to be in the courtroom, then any of my witnesses can also be in court when others are testifying. And so that was agreed to. And Frank was there the entire time.
Let's use as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now back to the trial. Mrs. Duncan is there. This, again, vivid picture of what's going on at this trial with all these characters present. Frank comforting his mother. But his mother exhibits her demeanor at this trial is very, very interesting. Tell us some of the things that she does when witnesses testify against her.
Right. She's very volatile, to say the least. And she sometimes just disrupts court and will call out that they're lying, that they're liars. She's called the DA a son of a bitch a couple of times. And at one point when she feels he's too close to her while he's asking the questions and she's in the witness box, she actually raises her hand as if she's going to hit him. But that's those things. Also, she can also be very charming. And so when she gets, and that's why Gustafson is trying to provoke her when he's asking her questions, because he's afraid that from the beginning of the trial, where she has been charming when Sullivan first was asking her questions, that they might think that she's just this sweet mother who maybe was too attached to her son. And she's always worried it only takes one to hang a jury. And so he's very concerned about that. And, you know, I realize also, if you want me to discuss it now, is we started to talk about my reading of the newspapers and my really obsession with this case, because it is a true crime memoir. And I have kind of in the chapters that have to do with my family, my father wrote this somewhat whimsical column about our family that was appearing in the same newspaper as the stories of the crime that he was covering. And so I go back and forth about my concern about Olga, my worry about her and what has happened. And my, you know, it's kind of a hard-nosed little girl, maybe a little like Roy Gustafson. And I think children sometimes are. It's very black and white about right and wrong. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you as a school principal that, yeah, children don't see the gray areas. They feel that if somebody has done wrong, they should be punished for it. And my dad also, there is humor in this book because his columns were humorous and he was just kind of a very funny guy. And I know that that sounds odd to pair that with a true crime story, but this is the life that I lived. And it seems very normal for me to have kind of a dark humor life going on at the same time that there was a true crime case going on. And I sometimes, when people used to ask me about the book, and they say, well, what's it about? And I said, well, it's kind of like Dave Barry meets Anne Rule in Fargo. Because it's Dave Barry wrote, if some of your listeners aren't familiar with him, he wrote a very humorous column that was frequently about his family. Anne Rule, everybody knows, wrote True Crime. And Fargo, that movie, it was these bumbling killers. And there were parts that were almost humorous. So I think that somewhat describes the book, because there is a lot about what was going on, life in the 1950s. It was a much more innocent time. And it was really just sort of on the cusp of when everything started to change in society. It's just before the beginning of the 1960s, you know, when President Kennedy was elected and then assassinated. And you know, things changed during that time. And I do believe that part of what I was so taken with this crime, and it was such a pivotal moment for me to discover that she'd been kidnapped and then murdered, was that things like this didn't happen in small town America. Maybe it happened down in Los Angeles or up in San Francisco. I didn't know, but not in my very unsophisticated little community. So there is kind of a contrast between what goes on in everyday life in the 1950s, and then what has happened to Olga Duncan.
Back to this trial, and this is a death penalty case, again, something that California has grappled with in many states, and federally, society has grappled over the death penalty itself. In this particular case, you talk about Roy Gustafson. Their attorneys, Baldonado and Moya, approached him about the possibility of having a life sentence.
Right.
And what was his reaction? And let's get back to the trial and the details that Frank Duncan, the person that didn't believe his mother could hurt a chicken, apparently, the details that he gets to, unfortunately, here about how his wife was killed.
Right. Okay. Well, yes, Moya and Baldonado, who both had very good attorneys appointed for them, tried to get Roy Gustafson to agree to take the death penalty off the table. But the death penalty in 1958 was that you were eligible for parole after 7 years. And Roy Gustafson, even though that would have been unlikely, was not about to do that. He did agree to separate their trials from Mrs. Duncan if they would testify against her. And so that's why Moya and Baldonado testified against Mrs. Duncan with no assurance that they wouldn't receive the death penalty. And Frank heard, he listened, it was when Moya was testifying, the excruciating details of how they had taken Olga out of her apartment, beat her and strangled her in the car as they drove away. The car was having car trouble, so instead of going all the way to Mexico, which was the original plan, they drove off on a road and headed towards Ojai. And there, about 6 miles across the county line into Ventura, they killed Olga and buried her in a shallow grave. And it was very detailed what Moya said about the killing, the beating her with the gun, the breaking the gun, strangling her, finally hitting her with a rock. And Frank just couldn't listen to it. He finally jumped out partway through and ran from the court, the courtroom, and his mother was calling after him at the time. And there's a picture in the book, an Associated Press picture, that shows Frank leaning down with his hand on his head. He looks very upset. And Mrs. Duncan is sitting there looking at her son with her arms crossed and just kind of giving him a disgusted look. And it turns out, because I have the Associated Press picture, so they give the caption that this picture was taken when Moya was discussing the details of his wife's murder.
Incredible. It doesn't take long for this jury, despite the vigorous defense by Ward Sullivan and his team.
Right.
What is the verdict?
Well, and I will say Ward Sullivan insisted that this was still the extortion, that these men were trying to get money out of Mrs. Duncan to pay back Mrs. Escobar.
Sure.
So the jury takes, I believe it was 3 hours, 3.5 hours, mm-hmm. into a guilty verdict.
And a death penalty. And then the trials of Baldonado happened shortly after, and Moya as well. There's the same results, death penalty.
Right. Well, they had already pleaded guilty because obviously mm-hmm. we testified. So it was just over the penalty phase.
Yeah.
And they also received the death penalty. And I thought that the judge in the book, he was also in his 80s, Judge Blackstock, said before he passed their death penalty, is anybody who thinks that I haven't thought about this penalty day and night and every hour all in between is wrong, and that if you're going to be a judge, you have to be a judge. And he pronounced the death penalties for those two also.
Absolutely. And as per typically, there's an appeals process in California. They went through that entire process and all those sentences and convictions were affirmed, weren't they?
Right, they were. And at the time, it was Governor Edmund Brown was the governor, and he had run on a campaign. He mentioned it. It wasn't like a big thing in his campaign, but he wanted to do away with the death penalty once he was in office. And he ultimately appealed to him to commute the sentence at the end, and he wouldn't do it. Even for him, somebody who was opposed to the death penalty couldn't step in for these three because it was just such a heinous crime.
You speak about these, any kind of sympathy for these two criminals. In July of 1960, what are these two guys involved with?
They try to escape from San Quentin, a very big prison in California where death row is. And I don't know exactly what they were thinking, but they really didn't have a prayer. But they, when a guard was down in the cell block, one of them attacked him. They were in it with other inmates. And They eventually got him out of there with tear gas, ended the jailbreak.
When finally all the appeals were exhausted and their execution date was finally set, there are certain people that attend this execution. Your father, Bob Holt, was he one of those people that attended?
Yes. All the executions happened on the same day, August 8th, I believe it was, 1962. Moya and Baldonado were executed. They had two chairs in the gas chamber, if you believe that. So that both of them were executed at the same time, and Mrs. Duncan later that afternoon. And my father was there to witness all three of the executions.
Was there any statements, any interesting statements from any of the defendants?
Well, when Moya and Baldonado were led into the gas chamber, Moya was very subdued, but Baldonado was just being very jovial and kind of joking around and waving at people that he could see on the other side of the glass that were there to witness the executions. And Mrs. Duncan, when she was brought in just before she went into the chamber, she asked the warden, where's my son? Where's Frankie? And he wasn't there. He was down at the appeals court in San Francisco making one last try to get the execution stopped.
Now, this book, you say, is a tribute to your father. Tell us a little bit about the effort to put this book together and that tribute to your father.
The effort to put this book together, it took me 9 years, obviously not constantly writing, but you know, I tried to write it in a number of different ways. At first, I thought I was going to fictionalize the story, but that just didn't work. It was stranger than fiction.
Right.
So but I had all of these transcripts. There's 5,000 pages of trial transcripts.
Yeah.
And I also had an unpublished account written by Roy Gustafson that I was able to look at to give me insight into the trial. Mm-hmm. So a lot of what you see as far as dialogue in the scenes, I got from the transcript. So these people actually said these things, both in the trial. And then I got some of the stuff I decided not to have to write about the grand jury, just the results. But there was a lot of testimony in the grand jury that I could use so that what the people involved said was authentic, that these were words that they'd actually said in court,
right,
or that they had given in a newspaper story. And a lot of them were interviewed for newspaper stories.
And so you write near the end or at the end, you say that this book was something, an idea that your father had, but he just never got around to it.
Right. He was always going to, he said he was going to write an account of the Duncan case. That's what he referred to it as, the remarkable Duncan case. But, you know, I thought of writing it in just a straight true crime at the beginning, but it's very complicated and it's not easy to do that way because we sort of knew who the killer was right from the get-go. But he died suddenly. He retired at 65, and that's when he was going to write this, but he passed away suddenly when he was 69. So there were only 4 years, and he did have a lot in files, but he hadn't written any chapters or anything like that.
Well, I want to congratulate you on this book because I'm certainly certain that he would be very, very proud and very, very happy with what has happened with this book, A Lovely Girl, The Tragedy of Olga Duncan, and the Trial of One of California's Most Notorious Killers. I want to thank you very much, Deborah Larkin, for coming on and talking about this book. Is there any social media you do? Do you have a website? Tell us about that if you can.
Yes, I have a website, DeborahHoltLarkin.com. I have an author page on Facebook, Deborah Holt Larkin Author. And I also, my Goodreads author page isn't really up and going yet, but soon.
Another source. Yes. Thank you so much. Again, thank you so much. A Lovely Girl, The Tragedy of Olga Duncan, and The Trial of One of California's Most Notorious Killers. Thank you so much for this interview. Have a great evening.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Thank you.